I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 124 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. Our guest this week is former Violent Femmes drummer Victor DiLorenzo, also a stage and screen actor who still plays in bands. DiLorenzo grew up in Racine, Wisconsin before moving to Milwaukee, where he and bassist Brian Ritchie started Violent Femmes in 1980. They called themselves Violent Femmes because, well, DiLorenzo will explain. Violent Femmes grew from a rhythm section to a band with the addition of singer-songwriter-guitarist Gordon Gano. DiLorenzo played on a minimal kit that included his own invention, the transiphone, a metal basket inverted over a tom and played with brushes. The setup was good for busking, which was helpful because some clubs thought Violent Femmes were too weird to book. So the band busked all over Milwaukee, including in front of a theater where the Pretenders were scheduled to play that night. What happens next is a hell of a story. What did DiLorenzo think of Gaino's songs when he first heard them? What role did DiLorenzo and Ritchie have in arranging them? How did the bass and drums intro to Blister in the Sun come to be? And would the entire crowd air drum the... When DiLorenzo played it, why did DiLorenzo's father finance the recording of the band's groundbreaking self-titled first album? How did Violent Femmes wind up on Slash Records? How did the band decide which songs would appear on the debut album and the follow-up Hallowed Ground? How did DiLorenzo feel about the religious themes of the latter albums?
Kiss your mother goodnight and remember that God saves. Kiss your mother goodnight and remember that God saves.
Why was Jerry Harrison of Talking Heads enlisted to produce the third album, 1986's The Blind Leading the Naked? Were Harrison's Milwaukee roots a factor? DiLorenzo plays on two more Violent Femmes studio albums, Three, which features the MTV hit Nightmares, and Why Do Birds Sing, which kicks off with another fan favorite, American Music. But as DiLorenzo tells it, things were turning sour within the band. By the time of the 1994 studio album, New Times, DiLorenzo was gone, baby, gone. What happened? Why didn't DiLorenzo's subsequent reunions with Violent Femmes stick? How did DiLorenzo feel about Ritchie's lawsuit over Gaino's sale of Blister in the Sun for a Wendy's Frosty ad? Does DiLorenzo like hearing Blister in the Sun on sports broadcasts and elsewhere? How involved was DiLorenzo in the new Kraft Recordings 40th Anniversary Deluxe Box celebrating the first album? Can he envision playing with Gaino and Ritchie again? DiLorenzo also discusses his acting career, including his tryout for Brian De Palma's The Untouchables, his theater work after he left Violent Femmes, and his role in a new short film. He tells of his current work with two bands, 1913 and Night Crickets, and he reveals what happens to the Violent Femmes movie that was in the works. Add it up, and you've got a rockin' Caro Pop episode with Victor DiLorenzo. Enjoy. Are you in Milwaukee proper?
Yes, I am. On the east side of Milwaukee.
How long have you lived there?
Let's see. I first came up to Milwaukee to go to college in, let's see, when was that exactly? 1984. I came up here. I grew up in Racine.
You were not tempted to like go LA or go New York at any point?
No, I tell you, Mark, I traveled so much that I never really had that hunger to move anyplace. And we were raising our family here. I've got three kids, and there's a great school system where we lived in Whitefish Bay. That's before we moved here to the east side. But all my kids are grown up now, and they're out of the house. So there was really no more reason to live in Whitefish Bay. It was a pretty expensive community to live in, but the school system was absolutely brilliant there.
Right. So. I love Milwaukee.
That's why we made that choice. Yes, it's a wonderful rebirth is taking place here, which is probably started about 5 years ago. But there's a lot of arts community activity here. There's also incredible restaurants that have sprung up over the last 5 years. And also, it just seems like it's just a friendly city to be in. I've always enjoyed living here.
Your Twitter profile says actor, writer, producer, director, musician, engineer, founding member of Violent Femmes, actor with Theater X, member of 1913 and Night Crickets. Are those in order of importance? Like, is actor, writer, producer, director before musician in your life?
Yes, because I started out in show business as an actor. My mother had me doing print ads in Racine when I was growing up. So when I was about 9 years old, I was already being featured in certain print ads in the Racine newspaper, and then also in the Milwaukee newspaper a little bit. But I always found that I was interested in movies, because in movies or television programs, you incorporated everything that I was interested in: acting, writing, directing, music, the technical aspects of television or film. All those things were very interesting to me when I was in high school. So, and even before high school, but especially in high school, because I got to concentrate on especially the acting bug that I had. I had a teacher, Father Raitzer, who was very good at not only being a director of the plays, but also instilling a love in all his students for theater and for drama and for good writing.
So your acting bug preceded any music bug you had?
Yes.
Did you think, oh, I want to be a filmmaker, or did you want to be a movie star, or like what was it? What was sort of the 10-year-old Victor dream?
I guess in my mind, the thing that really connected was, here's an opportunity to be someone else. For some reason, that was very intriguing to me, that you were given permission by being an actor to be someone else. Mm. And I know it sounds a little bit esoteric, but that's something that I was thinking about in my young age.
No, I think that's a sort of a basic attraction of it. Just get out of your own skin, get into someone else's skin. I mean, in one hand, you're being empathetic and sympathetic with someone else, and that's great. And on the other hand, you also just get to escape whatever your own worries are for that period of time where you're being someone else. Mm-hmm. And maybe you get to do things that are sort of more larger in life than you do in your regular life too, or more dramatic at least.
Well, I found that all through my creative career as an actor or as a writer, I found that just giving yourself permission to do things is very important. And as far as being an actor, I always felt, just because of the people that I admired as actors, that there was always a real bona fide sense of truth about what they were doing. And I found that really helped to guide my career as an actor, and also carried into my career as a musician. It's always about truth in one way or another, I think. Mm.
You acted with a group, Theater X, in Milwaukee for, I think, 20 years. Did you find something particularly rewarding about doing theater as opposed to doing, you know, the stuff on camera? Is that also just what was most available living in Milwaukee?
Well, of course, when you're young, that's what's most available, unless you're going to go out to Los Angeles or go to New York or Chicago. I mean, I did have an agent in Chicago, and I did read for some films. And in fact, one of my favorite memories is getting to read for Brian De Palma for a role in The Untouchables. And it turned out that it came down to me and one other fellow. So I would have had the role of, I don't know if you saw the movie Untouchables, but
of course,
there's a role for a young reporter that's constantly bothering Al Capone in these news conferences.
Right.
And I was reading for that role, and it came down to me and this other fellow. But then I unfortunately lost out at the end, because the other fellow was related to one of the producers. So I got etched out by nepotism.
Oh, well.
Yeah. But I did get to read for De Palma. And that was interesting, because when I walked into the room to read for Brian, the person that was leading me into the room was the famous casting director, Lynn Stallmaster, who was a really nice gentleman, really wonderful. And when he's walking me into the room, he's saying stuff like, "And now I'd like to introduce Victor DiLorenzo. He's a brand new actor on the Chicago scene. He'd like to read for you today for the part of such and such. And here's Mr. DiLorenzo." And I'm like, oh my God, this is really incredible. So I sit down. And De Palma's assistant, who was sitting next to him, said to me, "Excuse me, is that DiLorenzo or De Lorenzo?" And I said, "Well, it's DiLorenzo, and it's like De Niro or De Palma."
Ah, there you go.
And so Brian De Palma's looking at something and he looks up over his papers at me like, who is this jackass?
I thought that was a pretty good answer. I mean, that, you know, it's
but
it's
you know what? I learned early on that you have to do something to make yourself stand out.
Well, did you play on the fact that you were, you know, the drummer in Violent Femmes and they were a pretty popular band at that point? I mean,
no, they didn't come into anything at all. I don't see those two worlds being part of one another. I see them as two separate things. So unless someone brings that up to me, I very rarely let that be known.
You wouldn't send like one of your videos along and say, look, here I am on camera drumming.
I don't know.
Interesting. Well, at what point did you pick up the drums, and were there other instruments you were interested in first, or was it always drums?
Well, in grade school, I started out playing viola, and then I took piano lessons. And then when I was about 16 years old, my cousin Michael called me up and he said, hey, Victor, my friend Mark Francetic is going to Vietnam. He's got a 4-piece drum set with cymbals and stands that he wants to sell. Do you know anybody that might be interested? And at that time, I wasn't playing any instrument, and music, of course, was important to me, but I was more involved in the idea of writing plays or being a director or being an actor. But my cousin called me, wanted to know if I knew anybody that wanted to buy the drum set. And I said, no, I don't know anybody that wants to buy this drum set, but I might be interested. And I couldn't even realize why I was even saying that, because I never thought about buying the drums or being a drummer. So I was working at the Holiday Inn in Racine, and I had some money at that time. So I figured to help out my cousin, and also I was a little bit interested, I bought the drum set. So I had this real nice 4-piece Slingerland set, which was like a black oyster pearl. And I had it in my parents' basement where I was living. And I would come home from school. I was still in high school. And I would come home from school and I would see the drum set there, but I didn't know how to set it up. I would just look at it every day and hi. So I found out of a friend of mine that was a drummer could come over and show me how to set up the drum set. So then after I had the set up, I just started playing to records and eventually I started studying with a fellow in Racine named Joe Police, who was a very gifted drummer and teacher especially. And that's where I developed my love for the brushes. And that's what I'm kind of known for in Violent Femmes, because I took a traditional brush approach and I bastardized it to play rock music.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like a 4-piece kit for you would have been a lot, because you were sort of known for the whole minimalist kit with your snare and your transophone and your brushes.
Well, I went through my Carl Palmer period where I had a 12-piece drum set.
Wow.
So I did it all. I mean, I played one drum, I played 12 drums. It was all interesting to me because I found it fascinating the different drum systems that all the individual drummers would devise for themselves.
Did you pare it down out of sort of an aesthetic preference, or was it sort of practical in that, you know, you guys started playing out on the streets and it was easier to just carry a few little pieces, or was it also just driven by the music you turned out to be making?
Well, when I had my first band, which was called Fresh Lettuce in Racine, I played sit-down drum set. When I got to Milwaukee for university and then eventually started playing with Brian Ritchie, we had an idea that we were going to have this rhythm section that was very portable. So at that particular time, he just had an acoustic guitar that he put 4 bass strings on. This is before he bought his Ernie Ball Earthwood acoustic bass.
Okay.
That he became famous for. And then I just had a snare drum with a stand and a case and some brushes. So I was completely portable. I mean, I could set up my whole rig literally in under a minute. So that made it very feasible for us to play on the street.
Did you guys get to know each other in school then? Like, how did that connection happen?
No, I just met Brian because of a mutual friend that we had in common named Jerry Fortier. Jerry Fortier also had a band called the Trance and Dance Band. And so at one particular time, after I had met Brian, he and I played in the Trance and Dance band. And then later on, we borrowed the name Trance because of being in that band and playing with Jerry, that I christened this folk art instrument that I invented called the Transophone.
Right.
And that was because of the Trance and Dance band.
And the Transophone was an overturned metal bushel basket and over a tom-tom?
Over a one-headed floor tom that was mounted on a snare drum stand. And then you would play with metal brushes. So you would get a little bit of a ping out of the metal bushel basket, but then you could also play on the top in the center, and you'd get a little bit of the thump out of that floor tom that was underneath the bushel basket. So it was a weird folk art instrument that we invented it was supposed to be part of a percussion section that was going to be involved in the musical aspect of a film that Jerry Fortier was making and that Brian and I were helping him do the soundtrack for. So we figured, okay, we need some kind of a percussion sound here, but I didn't want to just use a cymbal or a drum or maracas or what have you. So that's what we put together in Jerry's attic, this Transophone thing, because he had all the parts sitting there and it was just a matter of putting them all together.
So you were just kind of experimenting, like we want to invent some sort of percussion instrument, and that's what you came up with. And then you're like, I'm just going to keep playing this on rock records.
Yeah, it just had a nice sound, and it gave me a unique instrument to play that nobody else had. And also, it just added to the offbeat weirdness that the Femmes were already cultivating at that time.
So, and you and Brian started Violent Femmes before Gordon Gano joined. Was it just the two of you, like as a rhythm section that would perform together, just bass and drums?
Rhythm section for hire, but people usually didn't hire us. We would just play with them. But that's how we started Violent Femmes, because we had this rhythm section. And one afternoon, Brian came over to my place where we were rehearsing in the basement of this apartment I was living in by close to the UWM campus. And he came over one afternoon and he said, "Hey, Victor, I think I have a name for our rhythm section." And I said, "Oh, really? What is it?" He said, "Well, I don't know if you'll like it, but it's certainly something that you won't forget." And I said, "Really? Okay, what is it?" He said, "I was thinking, why don't we call it Violent Femmes?" I said, "Violent Femmes, okay, well, Femmes was a term that we used to describe someone that was effeminate. And the idea for him of someone who was effeminate but very violent just seemed really crazy to him. So he explained it to me that way, and I went, yeah, let's use it. Okay, why not? So when we finally met Gordon, because Brian had seen Gordon performing with his brother, Glenn Gano, at a little music place here in town. And Brian came back to me the next day and he says, "Hey, I was out last night at the Metropole and I saw this guy named Gordon Gano, and he's like a pint-sized Lou Reed imitator. He's got some really good material." And I said, "Oh, really? Okay, maybe we should meet with this guy." So we met with Gordon and we decided that we'd do some playing together.
What was the first song that he played for you, or the first one that you guys did together?
Well, that circumstance was fun because we had showed up at this place where Gordon was going to do a little performance, and it was a sandwich shop called the Beneath It All. And it was literally a room beneath at that time it was a laundromat over on Downer Avenue here in Milwaukee on the east side. So Brian and I showed up to see Gordon, and I brought the Transophone, and I think Brian, for some reason, at this particular show, I think he had a banjo, if I remember correctly. But anyway, we just sat in with him. We never rehearsed with him, never knew any of the material, just sat in with him and just started playing like it was our gig. And I think one of the first songs that we played was Blister, I think.
At the time, were you guys looking for, like, we need a singer-songwriter front man to, you know, make this a trio? Or were you just more like, we're just playing a rhythm section, we're just going to play with other people and see how it goes?
No, Brian and I had plans established for that summer. We were going to go up to Minneapolis and play with some friends of mine up there. We were going to start a band up there. But then things started to take off with Gordon. So, I mean, there was no reason for us to leave, to go anywhere, because what was happening in Milwaukee was something that we wanted to develop and possibly stick with it, because we thought it had a chance of maybe doing something for us.
What was your first impression of Gordon and his songs?
Well, I thought he was very young, because he was very young compared to me. I was the oldest in the group. And also, he had an attitude almost like someone that was a New Yorker, someone from the East Coast, which I liked. He had that little bit of an edge to him. But the main thing was, I was just very impressed with his songwriting, and I liked his singing. And his rhythm guitar playing was pretty good. He wasn't a lead guitarist by any stretch of the imagination, but played very good rhythm. And the three of us had a very unique sound together, and that's something that we noticed and were happy about immediately. It just sounded different from anything else that was happening in Milwaukee or anything else in the world of music as we knew it at that time.
So Blister in the Sun has one of the most memorable rhythm section intros, in that it starts off with, you know, the bass line, which is you.
Everyone claps to my snare drum. My snare drum is the hook.
Was that built into the song when he presented it to you, or did you guys come up with that?
That's what I played the first time I heard it. We're very good instrumentalists, Brian and I, and our forte is arranging songs. So when we would hear something, we would immediately figure out our place in that particular piece of material.
Wow.
And that's how it went for all the Femme songs. That was our department. Gordon wrote the chord progressions, the melodies, came up with the lyric, but Brian and I, we arranged all those songs.
So was Brian like, all right, I'm going to sort of do a bass line that's based on the vocal line, and it's just going to start off with just that, and then the drums, and then Gordon comes in? Like, how did that all come together?
Well, I think Gordon had the song, and of course, we didn't have that intro at first. And I think it might have been something that it just came to Brian, and he figured maybe we need some kind of a fanfare for this particular song. So how about this? And when he threw it at us, I just came up with that drum answer. It was almost like a call and response, to tell you the truth.
Absolutely.
And it just fell into place. And now, my God, a lot of different sporting events you hear on TV when they're going to commercial or something, they're playing the song, and you can hear everybody clapping along to my snare drum part.
Right.
So I think it's very unique in that way, that the hook is something that is percussion oriented. It's not a melodic motif or something.
How did you guys come to start busking versus, you know, I don't know if you were busking and also playing in clubs at the time. Like, how did that all happen?
Nobody wanted to give us shows because we were too weird. We were these psychedelic farmers that played on the street. And until people started to see the success we were having, people weren't interested to have us in the clubs. Then, of course, that changed once we became popular. Then people wanted us to play at their clubs. But I guess it became just out of necessity. We figured, hey, it's a nice summer afternoon. None of us are working. Let's rehearse, but we don't want to sit in the basement. Let's go outside. So that's how we developed our knack for busking.
And you all had pretty minimal equipment, so you're able to kind of carry it over to the street corner and everything else.
Yeah, it was very, very, very portable.
How did people react to it? I mean, would they stop and throw money in Gordon's guitar case, or would they sort of
we knew we were getting across when people stopped to listen, and we really knew we were getting across when people threw some money in the guitar case. But at first, there wasn't busking going on in the streets of Milwaukee. Nobody was doing that. So at first, people just thought we were this strange oddity. And they'd see us and they'd go, oh, there's those guys again that play on the street. But after a while, people began to recognize us and say, oh, there's the Violent Femmes. So they would stop and listen to us because the word was starting to get around. that there was this unique group, these three guys, and they're playing some music that kind of sounded like the Velvet Underground or Lou Reed or something of that ilk. So people started to be interested in us now because we were the first people in Milwaukee to kind of push this folk punk kind of a thing. Because there was a big punk movement happening in Milwaukee. And Brian and I had actually played in some punk bands before we formed our rhythm section. So
did you have certain spots you guys would play regularly? Like, oh, it's Wednesday, so we're going to be on this corner? Or was it, did you just like have one place you went or a bunch of places?
It wasn't augmented to time or day of the week. It was more like, okay, let's go busking. So let's go to underneath the marquee of the Downer Theater because the acoustics were good there. Or we go underneath the marquee at the Oriental Theater because the acoustics were good there as well.
So you're also at the Oriental Theater when Pretenders are playing that night and James Honeyman Scott heard you. Isn't that your sort of 42nd Street discovery moment? You know, you just discovered at the soda shop sort of thing?
Yeah, like a Schwab's drugstore kind of a story, yes.
Yeah. So what happened there? Like, tell me about that. Did you think, okay, we're going to play outside the Pretenders show because we'll get a good crowd? Because
we didn't know who the hell the Pretenders were. We didn't know who they were.
Really?
We were more interested in Johnny Cash and Gene Vincent and the Art Ensemble of Chicago and John Coltrane and Albert Eiler and people like that.
Wow.
So as far as the Pretenders were concerned, they were just a name on the marquee. We had gone to Century Hall, which is a place that no longer exists here in Racine, which was a great theater and a restaurant and just a great meeting place. Unfortunately, it burned down about a decade ago. But anyway, we had gone to hopefully audition for someone at Century Hall because we wanted to play there. And we went into this fellow's office and we said, we'd like to audition to play here at the club. And the fellow said, well, just leave your cassette on the desk here and I'll get around to listening to it and I'll get in touch with you. And I said, well, we're here right now. We have our instruments. We can just play for you right now if you don't mind. And the guy was like, what? You're going to just play for us right now? And he said, no, I can't do that right now. I'm kind of busy. But yeah, if you get a tape together, come back and leave a tape for me. And we said, okay. So we left a little bit disappointed, a little dejected, went over to one of our usual haunts, which was underneath the marquee at the Oriental Theater, started playing our music. Guy comes out of the theater, listening to us for a few minutes. It's kind of laughing at some of the material and continues going up to the corner where the Oriental drugstore was. So he went up there because there was a sandwich counter. So I think he went up there to get something to eat or whatever. But then he came back. And he's listening again, and then he waited till one of the songs was finished, and he said, I got to tell you guys that there's a band in England right now called the Stray Cats, and they kind of sound like you guys, and the same kind of an idea, you know, this acoustic kind of like a busking thing. And that wasn't exactly true because they played electric instruments, but we were bona fide buskers in the acoustic sense.
Right.
So anyway, he said, well, you guys keep up the good work. So he went back into the theater. So we're playing a few more songs and then the door opens and then about five people come out and they're leaning on this car and they're listening to us and they're laughing. They're getting into the material. And we were doing this one song called Girl Trouble. And the refrain is Girl Trouble. I got girl trouble up my ass. And when we were singing that, the woman who was listening to us just started laughing like crazy. And we finished the song and they're all clapping. And they came over and they said, oh my God, you guys are fantastic. My name is Chris. Would you want to open the show for us tonight? And we said, open the show? What do you mean? And she said, well, we're playing here tonight at the Oriental Theater. Do you want to open the show for us? And we said, yeah, sure. Of course, I'd like to open the show. And she said, okay, well, listen, we can't pay you anything. You can have whatever food is backstage and you can certainly stay and see the show. Just come on and play three songs before we play. So we waited a little around until 8 o'clock, whenever it was that the show started. lights go down, and we come on stage, and everybody was thinking that the Pretenders were going to play, because there had already been another opening act called The Bureau from England. So people were expecting to see Pretenders. And then we walk out with our instruments, and I, you know, have that stupid transfer phone. And people are wondering, what the hell is going to happen? So we start playing the first song, and then we finished, and a lot of people were clapping, a lot of people were booing. So it's funny now, after the fact, many, many years later, if I meet someone that was there, they said, "Oh yeah, I was clapping. I thought you guys were great." And I was just thinking, "Yeah, you probably were clapping." But anyway, so we just did that show with them out of the kindness of their hearts. They let us open for them. But the next day we were back on the streets again. There was no big lightning bolt that hit us or anything. So,
do you remember the three songs you played?
Probably played Blister, probably played Kiss Off, and maybe Added Up. I mean, I can't remember for certain. We had first been in contact with a friend, became our friend, named Alan Betrock. And he had a magazine, or a kind of like a just a paper pamphlet thing put together, called New York Rocker.
Right.
And that was Alan's concern. He was involved as a writer and a publisher. So somehow he had found out about the Femmes and got in touch with us, and he wanted to come to Milwaukee and see us. So we came to Milwaukee, and he stayed at my house, and he came to see the band, and he wanted to work with us, wanted to do a record with us. So then we started scheming about where we're going to record, what are we going to record, when are we going to record? All these questions started to pop up. So we decided that we were going to work down on Lake Geneva at this place called Castle Recording. And Alan was going to put down a deposit so we could go in. Turns out we had booked the studio, and I think a little deposit was put down. But then Alan, at the last minute, had to pull out because he was having health concerns, and he couldn't fund the record anymore. So we were left high and dry, and we had to follow through because we had put down a deposit. And also, we wanted to get going. We wanted to make a record so we could get out there and possibly have something to promote, and that would help get us on the road. So I went to my father. I mean, we were trying to think about other people that we could maybe ask for the money, but we didn't really know anybody that had money. So I went to my father and I explained the situation to him, and he says, "Well, how much money do you need?" And I said, "Well, to do everything comfortably, probably $10,000, which is a lot of money at that time."
Right.
So my father, being the kind of man he was, he said, "Okay, I'll invest in you guys. The only thing I ask is that when you start making some money, you pay me back first." So we said, "Sure, we'll do that." So we took the money that my father gave us, and we went down and made the record under our own auspices. We didn't make the record for any record company or anything. It was just under our own speed.
Right. There was no one from Slash who was, you know, involved in it. You guys chose your own producer.
Yeah, Mark Van Hickey was a friend of mine that I knew from the world of theater. He was a composer, and I had worked with him recording music for Theater X and also for the Milwaukee Repertory Theater.
Did he have any influence on your sound, or was it pretty much you guys capturing what you'd been doing?
He just put up mics and captured what we were doing. He had a little four-track studio that he used to create music for theater that was in his apartment. So that's where we did our first demos.
What was the original thought? Were you going to then shop it to labels? Were you going to put it out?
Yes. Yeah, we're going to shop it to labels, and I did. And I got about maybe 20 rejection letters sending it to people. The only people that were interested were Slash. And that was because of this woman there. Anna Statman was her name. God bless Anna. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a career. Mm. And Anna kept bothering Bob Biggs, who was the president of the label, saying, "Listen, you got to listen to this. And I think we should sign these guys. I think they're very interesting, totally unique. And it's something I think that we could develop. There's something we could do with these guys. So finally, Bob Biggs went along with Anna, and they decided that they were going to sign us. And this was even before they saw us. This was just on the strength of the album, because what they got was the finished album. We gave them the finished album, sequenced and everything. So they put it out as is. They didn't really have anything to do with it other than, I'm not even certain if the record was mastered. I can't remember.
So they didn't mess around with it at all. They didn't say, oh, we need another song. We need to.
No, because Anna said, we got to just look at this the way it is and put it out. Also, I think that was attractive then too, because they didn't have to spend any money. They didn't have to put any money up front except for any publicity that they wanted to do.
Right. So how long did the album sort of sit before it was able to come out?
It came out pretty fast. I think within the year.
Like 83, I think it came out.
Yeah. Yeah, 82 going into 83, yeah. And then it started to catch on really fast through the good graces of college radio. That's where it just started to take off then. And also we got good reviews for it, probably because it was so unique and we were cultivating that uniqueness. So people either really liked it or they didn't like it at all. But if you wanted to hear Violent Femmes, you had to hear Violent Femmes.
Absolutely.
Nothing else like it. Nothing else like it.
Did you send a copy to, you know, Chrissy and James and the Pretenders and say, look what we did?
No, you know, the sad end to that whole story was
wasn't alive by then.
A few years after the fact, Brian and I'm not sure if we were invited or if we bought tickets. I can't remember exactly how it happened, but the Pretenders came through town again. And so we went to see them. And what happened was we saw the show and then we got backstage and we were in a room. Because we were waiting for Chrissy, we're gonna say hi to her and to the guys, and we're waiting and waiting and waiting. They never showed up. We found out that they had left and they went back to the hotel or something. So we never got a chance to reconnect with them. But I remember there was some interview with Chrissy Hynde where she talked about the whole story of the Femmes and us opening for them. So she was aware of it, of what happened to us and all that. But unfortunately, we didn't get a chance to talk to them again.
Did you guys stick around and watch their set that first night?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, sure.
Because you didn't really know them as a band. Were you
no,
impressed?
No. We loved just being part of the scene.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, wow, we're part of the real scene now. You know, not the scene for the Deadbeats, which is the scene that we're in.
Right. So now Kraft Recordings is putting out like this 40th anniversary. I think they're off by a year, but 40th anniversary box set mm-hmm. of the first album.
It just was rescheduled. It was originally scheduled to come out February 9th. It's now coming out March 1st.
Right. When you're recording this album in Lake Geneva, could you have any inkling that this was something that, you know, some big record company would be re-releasing in a $125 box set 40 years later?
I mean, of course.
Of course. It's like almost a rhetorical question.
No.
But certainly that it would happen.
We had no idea because we realized that the kind of tender that we were dealing with, it was odd. I mean, it was an acquired taste. So the idea to think that all these years later, they would be putting out this box set, which is absolutely brilliant. It's absolutely fantastic, Mark, in that the vinyl is first class. The pictures that were selected are incredible. The design is wonderful. When you take off the front of that box, the little girl, Billie Jo was her name, she's staring into the window, right? And what they did was they cut out the panes of the window and put some kind of material on the back of it. So when you hold out the cover of that box set in front of a light, the light comes through the window.
Ooh.
It's really in an interesting design thing. And I was just talking to Mason Williams, the designer over at the record company yesterday. And I said, man, that, whoever came up with that idea, it's fantastic. It's really cool. But the main thing I got to tell you, Mark, is that David Frick interviewed the three of us and wrote liner notes that I think he's going to win a Grammy for the liner notes because they're absolutely incredible. Not only talking about the record itself, but talking about us as people, as individuals together, as the band, as his take on what that music meant to him when he first heard it, because he really liked us. David really liked us when he found out about us.
Did he talk to the three of you together or separately?
No, separately, because we're all in different cities. So,
how involved were you in this project?
Oh, very involved. A lot of my pictures are from my archive, and all the other extra material, all the bonus stuff, is all from my archive.
Are you in touch with Brian and Gordon at this point?
I'm in touch in that we're doing work together as far as thinking about records. I mean, we're looking now at doing something special with Hallowed Ground, which is the second record that we made. So in that way, yes, but no, I haven't talked to them since we got together in 2013 and we did four shows together.
Caropop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Revolution has introduced a premium lager called Cold Time. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, and a touch of German hops and pure Great Lakes water. It's packaged brewery fresh and never pasteurized. The brewed low and slow badge on the can attests to a slower, lower temperature fermentation that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. Cold Time is available in 12 packs of attractive blue-on-blue 12-ounce cans.
Gather round, boys, to the tale that I tell. You'll want to know how to take a short trip to hell. It's guaranteed to get your
So Hallowed Ground, the second album, a lot more religious material on that record. It seems like it was material that you guys had been playing and that in a way you made a conscious choice to make the first album these songs that were maybe more pop, and then the sort of more country, the country death religious songs ended up on Hallowed Ground. Were there band discussions about like the direction you would go, like how to follow up that first record, or was it really like, you know, Gordon saying, okay, these are the songs for the second record?
Well, Gordon had this infamous notebook where he had tons of songs. So by the time we were figuring out what was going to be on the first album, we had already played all the songs that were on Hallowed Ground already, and some of the songs that were going to be featured on records that were going to be released in the future. So we had a lot of the material already, and of course, being a vinyl record at that time, there was only so much time you could put on each side of a record. So we could only release, 16 minutes of material on each side. So that came down to making those choices of those songs that end up on the first record. Those were the songs that we liked, that we thought would give us the best chance of getting over to a larger audience. The second album, Hallowed Ground, is also, as a matter of fact, our favorite record. The band, that's the record that we like the best. So that collection, yeah, it did have some religious material on it, as some of the other records in the future would have some religious material. But that never bothered us. I mean, that was part of what Gordon was and what he presented to us. So I was a little more open to that material. Not that I'm a very religious person, but I'm all for freedom, having come from a theater background. And Brian was a little bit more hesitant about that. It didn't make him feel right. But eventually, because it was unique and it added to the weirdness of what we did, then he started to like it.
Was it more important to you to do something that's kind of interesting and weird as opposed to kind of, oh, we need to build on the success? Like this one, you know, the first album got us to here, so the next one has to get us to the next level.
No, we didn't really think that way. We just thought that we were going to put out each collection of songs the way that we wanted them to come out. So obviously everybody, groups, solo artists, you always have some kind of a difference of opinion with the record label. It's just part and parcel of what it is. So we would have discussions with the label about these songs that are in this collection. Why did you pick these? They would want to know, and we would have to come up with some kind of answers for them. But at the same time, we were just trying to keep the peace and also make sure that we were allowed to do what we wanted to do and we weren't curtailing to some kind of pressure from the record company, because they didn't know what they had. They didn't really know what to do with us, because we weren't like Los Lobos. We weren't like X. We weren't like the Germs. We weren't like any of these bands that they were dealing with.
Right. Those are the other bands on Slash at the time.
Yes. Yeah. So we, through the power of our, the strength in our intention, we made sure that those records came out the way that we wanted them to come out. And it's funny, years after the fact, I talked to some people at Slash and I asked them, what did you guys really think about the Femmes over there? And this particular person said, well, I thought because of the Femmes, I could eat lunch and dinner every week. And I said, what do you mean by that? He said, well, you guys by far were the biggest selling album that we had on our label. Nobody came close. I mean, that's how we built our business, was on your backs. I was like, wow, really? So.
There you go. You guys are meal ticket.
That's right.
So The Blind Leading the Naked, you know, the first two albums, you had Mark Van Hecke producing. Blind Leading the Naked, the third album, you have Jerry Harrison, fellow Wisconsinite, coming in. Was that something that the record company wanted from you? Is that sort of a sign of a little bit more of compromise between you and the record company? Or did you guys also think, okay, we're going to do something different?
Well, we wanted to do something different, and we wanted to work with a producer that had a little bit more clout. I mean, Mark was looked at as just one of us. And when you say he produced the records, well, we produced the records together.
Right.
Jerry was going to be a different circumstance, because we were looking to him to be a producer. So we would follow his direction. It turned out that Jerry was looking to collaborate with us. So it was more or less like a same circumstance where we were working with a producer, but we were really all of us producing the record together. We liked the idea of Jerry because he was from Milwaukee. And also he was in one of the bands that we liked, Talking Heads. We saw them to be, in a way, kind of in the same camp as us, because they were just as strange in a way that we were.
So what did he bring to that record and how you guys approached it?
I think the way that he made records with Talking Heads is what he brought to us. And we developed some of those songs in the way that Talking Heads would develop songs. And other stuff, we tried to go just for live performances, which was kind of what we did in the studio.
And were you guys happy with how that came out?
Yeah, I think the record has some really good material on it. I would love to see all our records, because they were mixed so hastily. I would like to see the records remixed. That would be a great thing.
Interesting. Yeah. And then the album after that was called Three, even though it was your fourth album. Right. And I don't know if that was emphasizing that three members of the band, here we are.
Yeah.
And started off with Nightmares, which is another one of those songs that, you know, kind of, you know, I remember hearing that one on XRT a fair amount.
Sure. Oh, God, yes.
So
yeah, and they played the video a lot on MTV too.
Right. So how was it sort of moving into that sort of MTV video era? Like, did it change, you know, I mean, you guys are on the street, you know, busking, and now you're making these videos and working with big name producers. Did the nature of the band change, or did you feel like it was still pretty much you guys doing what you were doing?
Well, dealing with a new experience was exciting. Getting some notoriety was exciting. Having money come into the picture was a little frightening. And then when egos stepped in, that's when things got terrifying, in that we started losing a group dynamic and it became more individualistic, which was sad to see because I had come from a theater background, so my bread and butter was collaboration. And now it was turning into almost like every man for themselves. So that was sad to me. And sort of a rot started to set in to the band, which was very sad. I like to think that we could have been together forever and had great times and be celebrating our 40th anniversary, but I guess it just wasn't to be.
So what about the ego stuff was pulling you apart? Was it, you know, Gordon is the singer-songwriter kind of asserting more control? I mean, you know, was it just, did it become less democratic? Like, what happened?
Less democratic and people choosing to be the autocrat at different times. Me too.
So Why Did the Bird Sing was the last of the albums you were on, which is the fifth album from 91. Starts with American Music, which is another one of those that has stuck around. You guys covered Do You Really Want to Hurt Me on that one as well. Were the signs of that in that record what you're talking about, or was this more stuff that was happening kind of behind the scenes?
Well, Gordon had another band too called Mercy Seat with his girlfriend. So that was starting to pull a lot of focus away from us. And I think she was filling his head with a lot of ideas, kind of like, hey, you know, you're the whole band. You don't need those other two guys. And I wouldn't be surprised if the record company was kind of doing that in a way too, because they always tend to do that. They try to go with what they think is the main impetus of the group and get rid of the other things, all in the pursuit of more money, of course. It just started to get falling into more of a competition and not trusting the other people, or drugs were involved too. I mean, at that time, of course, in the 80s, there was a lot of cocaine flying around. So that certainly doesn't help with decision making.
Right. Was that something that affected all of you or just some of you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, so we all felt prey to it.
So you left the band in the early 90s at some point. Why did you leave the band at that point?
I just didn't want to be part of it anymore. It had run its course for me. I didn't feel that there was a group dynamic anymore. And also, I was getting to the point where I wanted to get back into the theater world and also try and find a booking agent or a talent manager, whatever, so I could try to get into film and television. Because I figured, well, that's going to be looking out for myself, which is probably what I need to do right now, rather than trying to figure out what was going through the minds of my two partners. Mm.
And you were still acting in Theater X in Milwaukee at that time.
Yeah, whenever I'd be home for a stretch of time, if they had any play that was about to be mounted, I'd see if there was a possibility of me being involved with it.
How did those other adventures in acting go at that time?
Great. I loved it because I was away from the fence. And I could feel my worth as an actor again, which is what got me involved in show business in the first place.
So what were the projects and roles that you remember the most?
There were a lot. Boy, I liked everything we did. I mean, instead of going into particulars about one or the other, I just like the idea that I could use that part of my mind again that was living, that really could think about stuff in an artistic way. Because at that time with the Femmes, it was more or less like I had to try and find my place in what we were doing. And it wasn't easy when you have other people trying to get rid of you. So.
And it just felt less creative at that point.
Yeah, it just felt like it was a money dash. That's what it was. And the greed was setting in I don't know. It just became a situation that was untenable, and it was affecting my mental health. So I wanted to get as far away from it as I could.
Yeah. I mean, you rejoined them with them a few times. You did some touring, sort of ended, did another show, kind of ended. Was it always like the same issues that was, you know, ultimately pulling you guys apart?
Sometimes I would say, listen, I'll come back and I'll do this number of shows. Because they needed me, because they had fired the other drummer or something like that. And they were going to pay me some nice money. So I said, okay, I'll help you out. I'll do it. And then the last time when we got together, which was in 2013, I had just contracted for 4 shows. There was an idea that maybe we would go on and maybe we could repair our relationships and maybe we could even make another record, but it turned out not to be the case. And I just went my way and they went their way after those 4 shows.
And what was the reason for that?
I saw the same shit there. I didn't want to deal with it anymore. I could deal with it for 4 shows, but that was about it.
I had a blog and column in the Tribune in like 2007. And I looked up and I had a couple references to Violent Femmes. One was I did a piece on Brian suing Gordon over a Wendy's ad where Blister in the Sun was used for, yes, for Wendy's Frosties. And I think I made the straightforwardly, you know, presenting it and said, you know, if it's not as if Blister in the Sun would put anyone in the mood for food, but
right. No, that's funny. That was we had 2 different reactions to that. Brian was appalled. Oh my God, my artistic sensibilities. How can they take my music and use it to make money that they're paying me? And I thought, this isn't so bad. It's giving us some money and it's getting us out there and it'll probably help sales of the record and might lead to other better things. And something that always rang false to me was, okay, Brian, if you're so upset about this, then why don't you give me your share of the money?
Purify yourself.
You can wage your protest and everything, but why don't you just give me your share of the money then?
Well, and I hear, and I'll hear Blister in the Sun is like bumper music on like football games and stuff too.
God, it's used so many places now.
Like as someone who remembers, you know, hearing it in his dorm room in college, you know, that this is this mainstream.
It was just in that
everyone.
It was just in that movie about Michael Jordan.
You know, it was in the Air, right?
Yeah, they used Blister in there, and they also used Good Feeling. They used 2 of our songs.
So is that like sort of a, I mean, not to be tacky about it, but is that like sort of a steady income stream because they're using the original recordings for you all?
They pay very well, yeah, depending on how popular the song originally was. Sure.
So you were not frosty over the whole frosty sale of Blister in the Sun. I don't even know what happened.
Nobody was getting hurt by that song being used in the commercial. And also, I wasn't so precious about the music. I just didn't have that part of me. I figured, well, if someone is interested in using this to sell something, well, aren't we selling it by making the music anyway?
Right. I found something that I wrote from 2007, a little bit later, like a month later in September of 2007, because I guess they had announced the nominees for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I was always sort of like saying the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is stupid. Like none of the music I like needs to be validated by some official, you know, organization that, you know, Jan Renner is, or anyone is, you know, it's like, that's not what you love about music. You love that you discover your own stuff. You know, do you get caught up in the whole Rock and Roll Hall of Fame thing? Is that on your radar even?
Not at all. I mean, I'll watch the ceremony and stuff like that, but I'm not so caught up in it. And I just find it funny, all the different bickering that's gone on about it over the years. And now Liam Gallagher is all upset and that they got nominated to possibly be in there. And he doesn't want anything to do with it. So I'm curious to see how that pans out.
Right. Yeah. Sometimes people don't show up. But on the other hand, you know, I mean, if Violent Femmes got inducted, you could have, you know, like Springsteen and Lionel Richie joining you on Blister of the Sun or something like that.
Right.
So you don't see any sort of Violent Femmes, I mean, reunion happening in the near future or anything?
Well, listen, for the 40th anniversary, I had said to Jeff, the manager, Castellans, why don't you talk to the guys? And I think we have a great opportunity here. We're going to celebrate the 40th anniversary. Why don't we do a tour with just the three of us? No Horns of Dilemma, no other bullshit. Just the three of us, like it used to be in the early days. And let's do smaller theaters, bigger clubs, but just keep it kind of compact. And if we want, maybe even say it's a going away tour, whatever. But I'd certainly be interested in doing that with the guys. I think it would be fun, and I think the fans would love it. And they weren't into the idea, so.
And in the meantime, you're still making music. Yes. I was just listening to 1913, and so that's your collaboration with a cellist.
Yes, Janet Schiff is her name. And also, we have just added a keyboard player, too, named Matt Meisner. And we are in the process now here at my studio, working on a 5-song EP that'll probably come out in spring.
Okay, yeah. And
so working on that. But do you know the other group that I have?
Tell me about the other group. I think I have it down here somewhere.
Yeah, the other group that I have.
Night Crickets?
It's called Night Crickets, and that's with David Jay from Bauhaus. He and I are the rhythm section and also songwriters, along with this third fellow named Darwin. And he's a multi-instrumentalist that lives in the Bay Area. So we put out a record about a year and a half ago on Omnivore Recordings. And now a new record is finished, and we're just in the process of figuring out. We've got a few different offers on the table. We're figuring out which one we're going to take. So hopefully that record will maybe come out this fall.
And you've done some solo stuff too. You had an EP called Transophone.
I've got a bunch of records under my own name. Yeah.
So tell me about the songwriting aspect of it. Again, you're in Violent Femmes. You have a chief songwriter. Now you're writing and singing your own stuff. Like, was that, had you been doing that all along, or did you kind of discover later on, oh, I like doing this as well?
I was writing songs since I was 16. From my first band, Fresh Lettuce. So I wrote material for them. And then I wrote stuff during my tenure in the Femmes. And there was one song of mine that we recorded called World Without Mercy.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the very few, you know, probably there's only two songs that Gordon doesn't sing, and I sing both of them, that are Femmes songs.
How much do you like doing that? The singing and songwriting? The singing and songwriting that you're doing now.
Oh, I love that. But my main gig has always been as an actor. And so I just finished a film.
That was my next question.
That was done here in Milwaukee called Floodgates. And it's just been released to a number of different film festivals around the world. And we're going to see if it gets picked up, where. And I'm very excited about that because I have a good role in the film. And I'm also working with a lot of my old friends from Theater X that I haven't had the chance to work with in a dramatic sense for a long time. And it's fun. It's a good movie. I really like the movie. It's a short. It's not a full length. It's just a half hour film.
So it's something that'll maybe do like the film festival circuit.
Yeah, that's where it's been entered in a bunch of different film festivals. I'm sure it'll be here in the Milwaukee Film Festival, but we're looking to get it around the country in different festivals.
Awesome.
I did some acting in it, and also I just want to mention 1913 did the music for it.
Oh, cool. Do you have like screenplays in your desk drawer as well?
I've got some screenplays. I've got some plays that I wrote. Different parts of plays in Theater X I had a hand in writing.
Are you still acting on stage now?
I'd like to. I mean, I haven't auditioned for anything in a while, but now that I've done this film, I have the bug again. So I'm probably going to look into nice. That. About 3 years ago, we were on schedule to do a film about violent femmes. And we were working with Chris Smith, who's a big film producer here in town. He did American Movie.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. But anyway, we had been talking to Chris, and we had a great director lined up, the fellow that directed Napoleon Dynamite. Okay, so this would be more of a documentary.
Okay.
About violent femmes. We were going to do this movie, and we had a great crew lined up. I mean, it was going to be really good. But the other two guys started getting nervous about it because they were starting to think about the history and their place in it. And they were getting cold feet because I said, the only way I want to do this film is that if it's completely true, if it's honest, if it's based in the veracity of what happened to us. And those guys were saying, well, you know, we want to have final cut on it and this and that. And I said, you guys can't have final cut on it. You're not paying for the movie. It's someone else's movie.
Right.
So you have to just trust these people that they're going to do a good job. And I think they are. So it got a little bit tenuous there. And then I think because they realized, oh, my God, if we're going to tell the truth about this, I'm going to come off like an asshole. So I mean, sorry, you know, you should have thought of that years ago when you were being an asshole.
Well, I would certainly enjoy seeing a violent femmes movie as well. So I hope
it would be good because the story is fascinating. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that a lot of people don't know behind the scenes and everything. Make a good movie.
Is there anything in particular you think they just didn't want in there, aside from just the general bad feelings?
maybe that's what we should call the movie, Bad Feelings. No, I wouldn't want the movie, Mark, to be just all doom and gloom, because it wasn't that. You know, the story of the femmes isn't that. I mean, there's certainly parts of it that are really obnoxious and horrific, but there were a lot of good times too, and a lot of accomplishment. And I'm proud of all the music we made. But
isn't that
those guys were scared that they were going to be uncovered as being jerks, and unfortunately, that would have happened because, you know, the story we're going to tell. It's if you're telling the truth, not everybody comes off in a positive light throughout the whole story of the femmes, and I'm included in that. So
I think that there are enough people who saw VH1's Behind the Music that there's always a roller coaster to all these bands, and they all go through their dark periods in which everyone comes off badly, and then at the end they've sort of put it all in perspective. So it's kind of the trope for these things. So if you just had like the sunny years of Violent Femmes from, you know, for 90 minutes, that wouldn't really be much of a movie.
Yeah, and nobody would believe it.
You least of all.
People that know us would not believe it at all.
That's all for episode 124 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Victor DiLorenzo for sharing the dreams and nightmares of Violent Femmes. The 40th anniversary deluxe vinyl edition of the self-titled Violent Femmes debut album is out now from Kraft Recordings. A 2-CD edition came out at the end of last year. You can learn more about Victor DiLorenzo and his work on his website, victordilorenzo.weebly.com. His band, 1913, also has its own website, 1913.com. Those numbers are spelled out. Night Crickets has a Facebook page, and its debut album, A Free Society, is available from Omnivore Recordings. You can follow DiLorenzo on Instagram at VJD and Twitter at Vic DiLorenzo. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake, who likes American music and all kinds of music. Now you can become a Carol Pop friend for a mere $24. Please contribute at carolpop.com. Your support is much appreciated. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Carol Pop on Twitter, X, and Instagram at Carol Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro, at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop Conversation. Thanks.